With new legal risks and regulatory challenges constantly arising, how can we stay current and be best prepared? Join me, your host, Ronald J. Coleman of Georgetown Law for Compliance and Legal Risk, a podcast brought to you by Georgetown Law and EY. In each episode, I interview thought leaders in areas relating to legal risk and regulatory compliance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Compliance and Legal Risk. As usual, I'm your host, Ronald J. Coleman, and I informally go by RJ. Today's episode is on legal and compliance in the year ahead. One of the things we really try to do in this podcast is help our listeners to be prepared for the legal and compliance-related challenges that they're facing now, or that we suspect they will be facing in the future. So I'm really looking forward to this episode because I think it will help us speak to that goal. I'm very happy to be joined today by three distinguished guests, Margaret Egan, Natasha Gerlach, and Arpinder Singh. So to get things kicked off, I'll ask each of our speakers to tell us a little bit about themselves, what they do, and how they got there. Arpinder, let's start with you.
Thank you so much, RJ. And great to be here talking to all of you. I'm Arpinder. I head the forensic and integrity practice for EY in India, as well as I'm the global markets leader. I've been doing this for a number of years. I'm a chartered accountant by background, and I'm also a lawyer. I spent a significant number of years in the US where I did my MBA, and I was a finance controller at Cisco in the Bay Area. So I've been on one side of the board, and I've also been a consultant for majority of the rest of my career. I came back to India in 2005, set up the forensic practice for a big four accounting firm. Forensic was a new concept in India, most companies in India, if you went to them, they would say there's no fraud. There's no compliance issue, there's no fraud, we're the cleanest, obviously. Time would tell a different story. Since then, obviously, it's become a very established practice within India. And I spent majority of my time, obviously, doing investigations, a lot of white-collar crime investigations. I also do a lot of advisory around compliances, helping boards set up proper compliance frameworks. I work with a lot of my global colleagues when they have cross-border investigations. So it's an exciting time in India as India grows as an economy. I'm sure you've been hearing a lot about India in the last few years. It's grown from an emerging market to maybe becoming a growth market as of today. A lot of global companies are coming into India. There's a lot of disruption, technology, obviously. We are in the forefront. I'll keep adding through the podcast, but great to be here.
Natasha?
Yes. Hi. Thank you, RJ, for having me here. And I'm a bit of the odd one out, perhaps, in a podcast on compliance, because I actually work now in policy, which is, I always look at it as it's the ex ante rather than the ex post. So we're working in the space before the law, and then a little bit on how to interpret it and how to shape it rather than how to comply with it. But I worked for many years as the head of the e-discovery practice for Europe for Cleary Gottlieb. So I can now say I worked on both sides there, I would say. Currently, I work as a director for privacy and data policy at the Center for Information Policy Leadership, or CIPL for short, and I'm located in our Brussels office. CIPL is a global think tank, and our mission is to work with our 90-plus member companies to identify current and future challenges when it comes to privacy, but more broadly data-related issues, and enable a dialogue with regulators and policymakers and academia and civil society to develop innovative goals and solutions and best practices at the policy and the implementation level. So our goal is always to inspire accountable and responsible use of data. I suspect slightly I'm here because I'm also on the advisory board of the Georgetown Law Advanced eDiscovery Institute. So that's my link here. And I'm also chair emerita of the Sedona Conference Working Group 6. So I think that's me. I went to law school in Germany, as you might be able to hear from my accent ever so slightly, and I did a master's in law in Kingston, Ontario, Canada, at Queen's University. I lived many years in the US and worked in different law firms, and that's where I got my start in e-discovery, where I I was at Cleary for I think almost 14 years. I switched into the policy world about 2 years ago now.
Margaret?
Thanks, RJ. Thanks for inviting me here. And it's really wonderful to be in this group with Natasha and Arpinder. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. So I am the general counsel of Hyatt Hotels Corporation. I've been in this position for about 6.5 years, but I've been with Hyatt for 20 years. I started my legal practice as a litigation associate in a rather large law firm based in Chicago, which is where I am today, where Hyatt's headquarters is. I did that for a while and then left. And for a couple of years, I worked with the U.S. Department of Justice at its office at the American Embassy in London, went back to private practice, and then found a great role at Hyatt. And I started my practice in litigation. I was a trial attorney and oversaw litigation matters with the DOJ. But when I came to Hyatt, that's how it started. And here I am with quite a few twists and turns along the way. And the litigation practice, it's a very long story, but led to other roles in transactions and then eventually to where I am right now. So I'm the general counsel and chief compliance officer at Hyatt. Hyatt has been in operation for almost 70 years, and I've lost count of the number of countries we operate in now, probably close to 80 around the world, with about 240,000 colleagues bringing our brand to life every day for guests who pass through our properties. It's a great job. It's a really fulfilling, wonderful job. We're a purpose-driven organization, and our purpose is to care for people so they can be their best, and we take that pretty seriously. So another aspect of my job is I'm the executive sponsor for our World of Care program, which is similar to an ESG program, but unique to Hyatt. And I think that's something we're going to talk about a little bit today. Really happy to be here and to talk about any aspects of what I do.
Well, I'm very excited. And as we can all hear, there's lots of expertise and disparate expertise on this episode. And the topic itself is also very broad. So we're going to take a little bit of a different approach than we normally do. Instead, I'm going to invite each of our speakers in turn to tell us a little bit about what they think we should be thinking about in the year ahead. So Margaret, since we ended with you, let's start with you this time. What types of issues do you think a general counsel or company legal department will be thinking about in the year ahead?
Well, I know what I think about a lot, and I talk to friends who lead legal departments at other companies, and it's really around the growing regulatory environment around our companies. So whether or not your company or industry is a highly regulated industry, large companies are regulated. They always have been, but they're in increasing ways right now. And so when I think about environmental sustainability, privacy, I'm sure AI, we're waiting to see what's coming through with AI, artificial intelligence, and navigating for us, a multinational presence with the very high interest in regulation now and the inconsistencies of regulations across jurisdictions, on top of the political side of it, which means you're not really sure whether the regulation you think you're operating under today is going to look the same next year or the year after. It all makes it very difficult to plan long term, and we have to remain very focused, very agile to navigate our companies through all of that. So I think about that a lot. I think about the regulatory environment, much on my mind with World of Care, as I mentioned before, is sustainability, environmental sustainability, and the regulatory environment that's growing around that in the EU, as and in really all most of the jurisdictions, large jurisdictions that we operate in. So that is something that we are working very hard to ensure that we're meeting the requirements. And you know, there's the regulatory environment, and then there's what your company focuses on that's important to your company. And, you know, there's what companies do that's important to them as well. So we talk about ESG. ESG has been a hot topic for several years. But the truth of the matter is most organizations have been focused on what it means to be a good corporate citizen for a long, 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 long time, and for the impact that we have in the communities in which we operate. So ESG is a layer over that, and ESG can be sort of a political football, as I might say, as an American, where, you know, one day it's the thing that everybody should be focused on, and the next day it's the worst thing that a company should be thinking about. It's not shareholder driven, you know, all the kinds of noise you hear around ESG. And so our focus remains on what's important for our company. So I mentioned earlier, we've been in operation for almost 70 years. We're a purpose-driven organization. So what does that mean to us? We are focused on things that are important to us. We focus our corporate social responsibility and our environmental sustainability platform, and even our approach to data privacy with the lens of care, of caring for our stakeholders and doing what our stakeholders need from us, in addition to managing the regulatory side. So I think a lot of companies have a hard time these days deciding what their focus areas should be, beyond the financial statement, beyond the P&L. Like, where should you have an impact? Where should you lean in and exert the good that your company can do for a greater whole? And to me, you have to just know what's important to your stakeholders, to what we are. So for instance, we focus our corporate social responsibility programs around education for opportunity youth, because in hospitality is one of those industries where you can come in an entry level position and be a leader at a hotel or even in a corporate office over time. So we're focused on that. We focus on inclusion because we have global citizens passing through our hotels every day, and our colleagues and our guests need to see that our leaders represent them and that we have the best, most diverse decision making that helps our organization. So these are when I think about ESG, and there's every day in my inbox, there'll be something about ESG is bad. And then the next day, ESG is good. We ignore that. That's all a lot of noise to us. And we focus on World of Care and what we have determined from listening to our stakeholders is important to us. So that's the what. And then the regulations and the disclosures are an add-on to that. That shouldn't change what we do. It only changes or impacts how we talk about it. But all of those things are a lot for an organization to navigate in difficult, politically charged, challenging times. And I think the core is to stay true to your own company's vision, what it wants, its mission, its vision, its goals, and then lean into that. So that was a lot. Sorry if that went on too long, but I'm happy to talk about any bits and pieces of it too as we go along.
Sounds great. So I think next, maybe let's go on to Natasha. And I'd like to hear a little bit about privacy and technology, and what issues you think we should be looking out for in the year ahead in that area.
Yeah, it was really interesting to listen, and thank you for that, Arjun. It was really interesting to listen to Margaret just now, because that could have come straight out of the simple playbook in terms of how to be an accountable organization. How do I approach these topics with that in mind, and where do I lean in? And Sybil has a number of projects running that speak to that, for instance, also where boards should focus. Why should boards be interested in privacy? Everything for us is sort of through the lens of privacy and data policy, obviously. But it's really interesting to hear you talk, Margaret. And so, when you ask a policy person, so what should we focus on? I think the answer, and Margaret sort of started to talk about this a little bit, is what should we not focus on? Because there is just so much going on, right? We live in very interesting and sometimes tumultuous times to those of us who work in privacy and data policy. I often feel like I'm running a marathon, but somebody keeps moving out the finish line. It is quite difficult to keep up. And while we can all agree, I think that, you know, recent technical advances are providing a lot of benefits to us all, like access to people, to resources, markets around the world, you know, the democratization of resources are a big topic of there. And most of us are embracing those. So I have heard a funny statistic recently. I do hope not all of that is true, though, but apparently it took us 75 years for 100 million users to adopt the telephone, but only 1 month for 100 million users to sign up to Pokemon Go. So that's sort of where we are in this world. But, you know, seriously, the digital economy was a lifeline to us, you know, and our economies and for us personally during the pandemic. So there are many advantages. And of course, at the heart of this, of what is often lovingly called the fourth industrial revolution, is data and vast quantities of that personal and non-personal data that already exists and that we continue to create. And there is this idea of data as a potential driver for economic growth and scientific research, et cetera. And here in Brussels, the European Commission introduced in early 2020 their European strategy for data. It's a digital strategy and AI white paper with the goal to empower businesses and people in a human-centered, a sustainable and more prosperous digital future. So there's this element of sustainability, right, Margaret, that you also mentioned. But looking at that, and we are meant to be looking globally, but digital strategies like the one the Commission issued come with new or expanded regulation, which, you know, keeps lawyers in shoes and handbags, but is really difficult for organizations to navigate, as Margaret also said. Since 2020, the Digital Policy Alert, which tracks digital policy making in G20 countries, the EU member states and Switzerland, has recorded over 3,200 digital policy or regulatory changes, affecting cross-border digital trade. So all of that, if you are a global organization like Margaret, that's something you have to navigate. Here in Europe, we've had our fair share of that. We've been inundated with a tsunami of new major legislation after we barely recovered from GDPR. We have the Digital Governance Act and the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Service Act and the Data Act. And now the EU AI Act, and it can be really difficult to keep up. All these pieces are overlapping. There are different regulators that are responsible and that have the potential of standing on each other's toes and that have to learn to work together with one another. And this is also what organizations face in when they navigate it. And in addition to that, these pieces of legislation, we now have over 170 of the 195 countries of the world have some form of data protection law that brings its own requirements for compliance. And they all, most of them have established some form of individual rights. Many of them are now taken inspiration from the GDPR. There are maybe restrictions on data transfers. They may have extraterritorial reach. So all of that adds to this puzzle. And then and I'll close with that. But a big part of the recent discussions has been and will continue to be, of course, AI here in Europe, in the US, elsewhere. And although, to be honest, I think all of us who have and are still working in legal tech were a bit surprised by this notion that AI and even large language models are new, right? They have been part of legal tech for a long time. We've all been working with them for a while. But of course, the discussion started when the technology and especially generative AI became commercially available to all of us. And so, you know, how do we approach that? And there's a clear understanding of the potential benefits AI carries, I recently met a young cardiologist who created a startup that uses AI, for instance, to analyze EKG data. And his algorithm can analyze in one day what normally would be 1 million doctor hours and at much greater precision, right? That's amazing. But the flip side are the potential risks AI can carry. And before generative AI came on the scene, sticking points were, you know, bias recognition, concerns around facial recognition, technology liability, etc. And so now we have a broader concept of what the potential dangers are, like you know, deep fakes, etc. What is the impact that this could have on our elections, for instance? We see a wave of sexually explicit material being generated by AI that is used for cyberbullying, for instance, or worse, you know, creating child pornographic material. You know, that these are real life dangers that we are grappling with, and how do you approach and govern this? And many responsible organizations have been developing policies on how to approach AI ethically for many years. But now we, of course, also have legislative and policy initiatives here in the EU. I mentioned that we have the EU AI Act, of course. The UK has taken a more of a wait and see approach on AI regulation, relying for the moment on existing legislation. The GDPR applies, of course, in this context. You have consumer protection laws, etc., that also all play a role. In the US, you have the executive order on AI that was issued in October of last year. And so these are, you know, the issues that are driving us. And so what do I think everybody should be focusing on? One is how do all these puzzle pieces fit together? How do organizations navigate this? But also, how do regulators navigate this? How do they cooperate with one another? And we do have digital regulator fora in some countries, like the UK has one, the Digital Regulator Cooperation Forum, where they have started to develop this, and we see this in some other countries developing. But this is a big topic. Data flows continue to be a topic also in the context of AI. And as I mentioned, many of the data protection laws that we have, they have some form of restriction of data flows. And yet the digital economy lives on the flow of data. And so how do we approach that? And for us, certainly, children's data is also a big part of what we work on and what we focus on. That's not a question for all organizations, but it is a big part of how do we keep children safe online. It's another big discussion area in policy. And I will stop there before I take up all the time.
And so now, Arpinder, from the perspective of someone with lots of forensic accounting and advisory experience, what types of issues do you think we should be thinking about in the year ahead?
First of all, I want to thank Margaret and Natasha. I think as complicated the laws are made, it's better for people like me, you know, because then you need consultants to help unravel the strings of knots, as we put it. So please go ahead, Margaret and Natasha, whatever you're doing, it's fantastic, you know, because our businesses definitely grows with this. Coming to what I see, I think I would like to start with something a bit different, like cyber. I think cyber bullying, you're right, what Natasha mentioned, but most companies, as they adopt technology, everybody thinks it's a really cool thing, right? No one has manual vouchers anymore, except for maybe RJ and Georgetown. Maybe they still in universities have manual stuff, but in most corporates, it's still automated and it's getting more and more automated. So there's nothing manual. Even everything is PDF, scan. What happens with that is it allows hackers to get their hands on more information. And I think companies have done a lot of technology advancement. And what we see with companies, they have not really kept up to date with the InfoSec requirements. You know, hackers are one step forward. They're really smart. And you can't trace them. You know, no matter how good an investigator you are, you can stop the leakage, but you can't trace the person generally. I mean, that's generally, most companies will say, no, we can trace the hacker, but trust me, it's super difficult. What you can do is stop the bleeding, and you can help companies remediate their system. Number two, I think, is most of these hackers, they have something called ransomware, which they freeze a certain part of a company. And I'm sure Margaret would be scared of that for her own hotel chain, right? If they freeze a portion of her system. But the fact is, once they do that, they ask for money in bitcoins. Now the question comes in legally, country by country, that can you play those bitcoins? Can you actually pay the ransom? Can you account for it? How do you account for it? And is buying bitcoins legal country by country, right? Every country has their own laws and regulations around allowing it. It's really, really complicated now on how you deal with it. And no one likes to accept the fact that they couldn't, they had a ransomware attack and they couldn't crack it and they had to pay the ransom. So how do you account for it? So that's become a bit complicated. I also feel a lot of C-level executives move from one company to the other. And I think they still have to be educated on confidentiality of information and the fact that they can move data from one company to another, maybe illegal. A simple thing like their contacts. If you're in the sales team, can you take your contacts when you worked in a company for 10 years and take it to another company? It's a very simple thing. It's arguable legally, but it varies again by country by country. I would say geopolitical risks. You know, that hasn't come up yet, but I think that's a serious, serious concern. I mean, most of my clients are doing sanction. No, the amount of sanction compliant work which has happened in the last 2 years has been significant. People don't know where to draw the line, right? Is it sanctioned employee? Is it sanctioned individual? Is it a sanctioned company? Is it a sanctioned country? It can get really, really complicated out there. Even when you do a sanction check, a lot of times you get false positives. You really don't know to the extent that it's sanctioned. A lot of clients of ours have actually shut down operations in a number of countries because of sanctions. They've moved out. So when you, I always call it sanctions is the new FCPA. You know, because the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act obviously was big for lawyers. I'm sure Margaret and Natasha would agree with me. But today it's more about sanctions. Most lawyers are engaged with corporates which are going through a lot of disruption because their trade cycles have been impacted. They're going through how do they do business with sanctioned companies or shut down businesses with sanctioned entities. So I think it's getting really, really complicated. Global trade is getting complicated. And with the recent news, it's getting even more complicated. So people, like for instance in India, we are constantly looking at our trade routes. How do we get oil? How do we get to refine it? It's a big question which happens in the emerging markets, and I'm sure in the developed markets too. When we discussed AI a bit, I feel AI is, everyone likes talking about it, honestly. I'm sure Natasha has a lot more experience because of her discovery background. But the fact is that reality is AI is still an unknown commodity. A lot of companies love talking about it because it sounds cool. At least people with my gray hair like talking about it because it makes us seem like we're still in it. But the reality is AI is still very not fully understood. Most companies don't even have a responsible AI charter. You know, so if you ask a company, do you have a responsible AI policy? Most companies will say they're working on it. What does responsible AI include? Obviously, how do you use AI? Is there any bias in it? Obviously, bias is inherent, right? It's data. At the end of the day, if you have data and you're learning from that data, right? And every technology, no matter what you call it, learns from data. And if you use the data and it's biased, then how do you remove that bias? I think is important. My biggest question is you mix data privacy and AI. Let's say a person whose data has been used to create a platform. And now the person says, I withdraw my consent. You know, I don't want you to use Medicare. Do you mean you re-look at the model? Because that a subset of the data has to be removed. So that means do you rejig the model and the result may be different. You know, so you never know. These are all theoretical concerns and theoretical concepts because it's such a new concept. The exciting stuff that I think all students or all people who are practitioners in the legal and compliance world could potentially must keep up to date with AI. Every software company has come out with their AI version. What is super cool is each one is better than the other. So you came out with the old version, then a new version came out, and I won't give names because people will think I'm actually supporting a particular software. But the reality is the newer ones are actually better than the old ones, and I can give a hint on that. Because, of course, they're more updated data. It's more relevant. I found it really cool talking about health claims where we put actually two, we're doing an investigation around the health claim, and we put two x-rays on AI, we uploaded it. And actually, the tool told us which one was fake and told us which parts of it was superimposed and why it was fake. So I think it's really cool because it can change the way compliance is done, where you can actually find fraud real time. Because historically, you can never find fraud real time. You can find fraud fast or you can find it quicker, but you can't find it real time. And I think AI can help companies on travel and expense reimbursements, procurement. You can actually find fraud real time on documents when you compare two documents, or you look at a document standalone and you can find fraud. So that's super cool, right? You don't, you can actually, a person puts in a DNA and you can tell immediately, hey, this guy's giving a lying or he's giving an incorrect statement. Talk about regulatory oversight. I think every country is extremely complicated. I mean, most companies grapple with, even India's currently, thankfully, a growing economy. They say it's going to be the third largest economy. So a lot of global companies are looking at entering India. But it's still fairly complicated, right? We have a very complicated legal system. So I think understand the regulatory aspects is very important for whether you're a lawyer or not a lawyer. You can't do business without understanding regulatory aspects. So I think that can differentiate one person, employee, and another professional, is if you understand the gravity of regulatory insight. And it's not just about getting a smart lawyer and hiring them. You really need to know it yourself, devil's in the details. Because you could get into a country and really do start off in a bad way. You could incorporate in a bad way, etc. But it's great fun because it's bringing new dimensions to your professional career in that sense. Last, I would like to say is greenwashing. You know, everyone's spoken about ESG. That's the good part. But the fact is, I think there's a big concern on greenwashing. I think reality is these numbers sometimes can't be audited. All these numbers are coming from systems which are, you know, ERP systems have been there for donkeys of years, you know, 20 years, 25 years. So they're vet tested, everyone's checked there, they're audited. Now, ESG numbers are a bit new. They sometimes don't come directly from the ERP system. They're not financial numbers. So I think that's some, that's a new area where people should be really cautious of and be careful when you accept those numbers. Because a lot of money flows through hedge funds, private equity, based on a company saying we're really green, or we're really compliant, or we're really ESG compliant. And having done a number of investigations in the emerging markets, at least where I primarily reside, is I can tell you the numbers can be questioned sometimes. Also the policies on how you choose which program, and as I think Margaret alluded to, is that sometimes you don't know what the KPIs are, what the key numbers are, what are the key metrics. I think those are also very, very critical. So those are some things. I'd like to just take another minute or two to talk about, you know, what we see from the compliance world. I feel there's a whole world around legal managed services, which is obviously Discovery was one of the first few which started many years back. But today there's a whole concept with increasing technology that can a lot of the legal and compliance work be done in a combined way, either through offshore or onshore, near shore. So there's a whole debate happening, which I'm exposed to because we are lucky in Philippines, India, Poland, there are a lot of back offices. And where there's a whole discussion on what portion of the legal services and compliance services should happen onshore versus offshore or near shore. And I think that's a very heavily debated topic, and technology has enabled it. You know, whether it's contract compliance or whether it's employment law, mergers and acquisitions. A lot of that now, the whole model on how that is done, where do the teams sit? I mean, recently I had a team sitting in India, which was acting like a general counsel for a large US entity. So how is that possible? You know, and those are the questions which I think will get more and more discussed. Talking about Discovery, you know, which was being mentioned by Natasha quite a lot. I would say Discovery is totally changed. In the old days, for instance, we used to have, you know, the review, the production used to happen, and the review used to happen with hundreds of lawyers, right? We'll have paralegals go through millions of records. And the reality is today, you don't need that. I mean, with some of the cool new discovery platforms, you can actually, you know, look through millions of records and actually get maybe 1,000 documents which you have to look in, which you can finish in a day. So the question is, with AI, I think what I find really, really interesting is, and Discovery is a great example, how you can actually automate it, how you don't need to run it manually, and you can actually, if a company has a problem, you can come back within maybe 7 days and say, this is the problem, these are the 5 key emails you should look at. You don't really need to spend months and months and do it. And most law firms may banish me after this podcast, but I think that's the way the system will change.
Natasha?
Yeah, may I just, so a couple of things. On AI regulation and on policies within companies. So Sipple just issued a report, a paper that we did where we mapped emerging best practices of leading companies who are implementing, developing or deploying and or deploying AI to see, you know, how do they approach it and how have they been approaching it in the absence of, you know, a hard law, for instance, because when you do deploy this, you have to ask yourself, how do I do this responsibly? How do I preserve the rights of those whose data is potentially in there? We have to remind ourselves that AI doesn't necessarily mind whether it's personal or non-personal data. In fact, most of it is non-personal data, but of course the issues will circle around the personal part. At least that's what the privacy world is focused on. And so, you know, you mentioned bias detection, etc. So we wrote a report on that, and we also have a report on our 10 recommendations of how to regulate AI globally, and all of the material is available on our website. So do feel free to look at that, because it's quite interesting to see the different approaches of companies who have been working with it. And Arpinder, you're quite right. Of course, e-discovery in the time I worked in it has changed significantly. And, you know, the models we've been working with, they have been able to sift through many more records than, you know, individual lawyers. I mean, I do remember the days of hundreds of lawyers on one case every day. You know, now it's the experts who can understand the models, who can train the models, who understand the statistics, etc., and who can improve the training. That's, you know, who you need in the seats there. But I think we sort of made another leap with generative AI. That is a new form, and that is something that is perhaps more difficult for many to understand and to get our arms around on what this means, because it seems real. It seems like, you know, it sounds like us. It has cracked the language code, I think. But of course, it's not sentient. And so we need to also maybe dial down the hype a little bit and approach this as any other legal compliance issue, but then also policy issue. What does this mean when we do think about how do we get our arms around it? What are the risks? But we cannot forget what are the benefits, and that must be weighed against one another. How do we ensure the rights of the individuals are preserved as we deploy this? What are economic considerations in this context, etc.? So I think, you know, to me, it's sort of the next shift that we've seen. You know, we've all seen, I'm definitely old enough to have seen the internet, personal computers, then you've seen mobile phones, and this is now the next thing. And I think we will see a lot of new technological advances in short notice, as we have seen, as each one of these things came, you know, commercially available. So the internet from universities and the military, and then personal computers into our homes, that changed a lot for all of us. And we saw a lot that built on that. And then the advent of mobile phones, and look at where we are now. And to me, this is sort of the next tectonic shift here that will spur a lot of advances. But that also means that we have to keep up with understanding not just the benefits, but also the risk, and how we can approach this in a meaningful and accountable way and responsible way. And so this is sort of where SIPL works. And so when Margaret said earlier, you know, the responsible corporate citizen, I was quite delighted, because that's sort of where we also work, and what we are trying to work out with all the stakeholders that do have to sit around the table to find practical solutions.
And may I add to that, if that's okay, RJ?
Definitely.
Natasha, you know, it's so true that this is a tectonic shift, and it is different than the ones before it, and the rapid nature of the changes and what it means in terms of decision-making. You know, what do you do with the data and the answers to decision-making? And also, what happens to personal data? What happens to corporate data? So speaking from the standpoint of a company that is not we're not a technology company, we use technology. We're a people company, but we possess a lot of data for our guests, for and customers, and of course, colleagues. And as I said earlier, we take care of that data because we believe it's the right thing to do. We also live in a regulated world. But now we're in this very unsure space. And this is where best practices and sharing of best practices is really, really important, because every good corporate citizen wants to do the right thing. Nobody wants to get themselves in a position where they have unintentionally misused one of their greatest assets, which is data. You know, given the number of millions of people who pass through our hotels every year, it's a lot of data. And so we want to do it right. And we're trying to figure it out as we go. And that's one of the challenges. I think most companies are figuring it out as they go. And, this is an area where I think sharing best practices and being quite transparent about that across industries, across companies, would benefit all stakeholders tremendously.
Yeah, I agree. I think even as you said, you know, you're not a technology company, but most companies now are, you know, technology companies in some way because of the use of technology and the use of data that you know, everybody adopts. As there's very few who use the fax machine, I would imagine, and you know, write letters by hand anymore. And so you know, by nature, you have a lot of data, and the digital economy and this whole system is built on trust. And so, you know, the trust of the customers or the individual whose data you hold, the trust of the regulators that you are doing the right thing, the trust of your business partners that you are doing the right thing, and they're, you know, finding convergence and best practices and sharing those is, I think, hugely important, and being transparent as to what you do. So, yeah.
Margaret and Natasha, I think you both were talking a lot about best practices. And Arpinder, I think you also were talking about actions in multiple jurisdictions. And Margaret, I know you deal with that. One question I had is, so if I'm a company and I have operations in more than one country, do I come up with different sort of policies and procedures for my operations in the EU versus the state of California versus the state of New York? And India, or do I pick the most prophylactic one and apply it to all my businesses so I don't have to have different policies? What do you think about that?
I think it depends. I think it depends on where your businesses are located and who they touch. So we, as an example, oh gosh, when did we start this process? Before GDPR, back with binding corporate rules, we decided that because we're a global business where our guests are passing through the EU, EU guests are passing out of the EU into other countries, that we would adopt the most restrictive of the privacy policies at the time and implement that globally. And so we were in pretty good shape when GDPR came along because we'd taken that approach. And as we go jurisdiction by jurisdiction, we do the analysis of, okay, well, is this a California specific rule? Is this an EU specific rule? Will it touch people that are from outside the EU who come into the EU, or will it touch EU citizens when they exit the EU and go to one of our hotels in Asia or the United States? So it's a contextual question. There are certain, we're also a US public company. So our SEC rules, that's it. That's at the top level. And all, we have a control environment across the entire organization to ensure that our financial reporting meets SEC guidelines. And in the event the SEC finalizes its rulemaking with respect to climate disclosures, we will likely sit in that sort of space. And that means that's global. But country by country regulations will depend a little bit on how far the scope should be. Because listen, we would prefer to not have 70 different legal, you know, legal environments that we're operating in with their own rules. We know that within each jurisdiction, there are going to be some different rules in terms operationally at the hotel level. But as it ladders up, we do try to simplify as much as possible. That way, if you're a guest and you go onto our Hyatt.com to book a room, the terms and conditions, you know what they are wherever you go across the globe, and that there's a usefulness to that. But so I didn't really answer your question directly, but it's a yes and, you know, it really depends.
If I can come in, RJ, on that and add. So I think what Margaret said is right. You know, global companies have complexity on regulations, but what I've seen as a best practice is generally where the home country is based, you know. So which is your strictest regulator? I think Margaret implied it with the SEC and the US. But the fact is you have to pick where your home country is or where your largest market is. And I've seen most companies pivot their first policy or their core policy in that particular market, which is most heavily regulated or relevant. And then I think you adapt to local countries where the law may change, you know, like in the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, which many years back we used to do across 100 countries. The rules may change about what you can pay a government official. Can you pay a government official? Is speed money allowed? Is speed money not allowed? So you'd have to tweak the policy country by country. But this is, I feel, more at the policy level. I think a lot of procedures get more complicated. So I think that, you know, policy is at one level, but the procedures under it have to be really specific to countries. So if you take about compliance with laws in India, you can't just take a policy is at a 30,000 feet. Within that, the compliance with laws have to be actually specific to that country. So that you will have to, unfortunately, do the hard work of going country by country at the procedural level, because a country like Greece may have its own laws. India has its own laws. So you have to, at some level, ensure that the compliance officer is ensuring somebody is complying with all the laws relevant for that country. So that does become, I feel, is becoming more and more complex because every country is coming out with their own laws. Like India has a data privacy law, so which is new, and everybody has to now comply with that and see how it's different from GDPR and make sure the policy is capturing some elements of that. So I agree with the policy at the 30,000 feet level, which can be core, and then you customize it a bit country by country. But the procedures is where really the battle is won or lost. And that's where a lot of the heavy lifting is happening country by country. But I would also say the additional complexity is some of the governments, you know. So a lot of the governments are maybe not agreeing with other governments, for instance, you know. And some governments may say, you know, this is okay with us, and some are saying it isn't. So I think that's adding to some of the complexities of companies which are really truly global.
I would agree with that. I think so. The GDPR is a good example, and I can assure you that the Commission and the EU in general, they're delighted with this Brussels effect that the GDPR did have. It inspired a lot of other laws, and so that made it perhaps, I don't want to say easier, but it has become sort of a baseline against which others are measured, and then you add on what is locally required. But as the digital lawmaking is becoming more complex, and as there are you know, potentially overlaps or conflicts within a member state, that adds to the complexity of it, and then it becomes very, very difficult. And also what we're seeing now, Arpinda, I think you are quite right, is sort of the sovereign restrictions, right? The DOJ's proposed rulemaking on sensitive data that goes into other countries. Now that we just you know have the DPF in place for the EU-US data transfers, now we have this, and so there are continuous developments that throw a bit of a wrench in this. And I think you know, the efforts that are being made on a more global level in the context of G7 or the OECD in particular on data flows are hugely important on this, and also on the policy level they are developing convergence, common understanding of risks and benefits and how to approach this. I think it will become more and more important as we go along, because it just is so very complex, and the technology is, you know, is not approachable for everybody, I would say.
Let me add to that too, that, you know, our company, just so I'm clear, we have a set of compliance policies that sits at the top of our organization that applies to every single colleague across the organization. We're trained on it annually. We have, you know, all the systems in place to ensure that those are well understood across the organization. Whistleblower training, tone at the top, everything that you would expect to see in a mature organization under the DOJ's federal sentencing guidelines. So we tilt, you know, obviously toward the United States, because that is where our corporate headquarters is based. But that those compliance policies mean following the laws in all the jurisdictions around the world and trying to keep up with them, which is a lot of what we've been talking about today, the difficulty in doing so. But to RJ's question, do you lean toward the most restrictive and just say, okay, I'm going to do it once across the board? Sometimes. The answer is sometimes, because that is the most simple way to do that. But in all cases, the obligation is to meet whatever the requirements are within the country in which you're operating. And so building an organization that can do that, that can pivot and be agile enough to pick up and make the changes as we go along, as the next set of regulations comes, as the next set of regulations comes that conflicts with the neighbor's regulations, as Natasha mentioned, and whoever's in charge next year who changes their mind. That's the difficulty for a company operating in this space today. One that we're all focused on, I think, necessarily so, but it is certainly a challenge.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it was, in some ways, it was a false choice. It's not the most restrictive. It's also whether it is possible consistently to comply with two things that conflict. Arpinder, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to agree with Margaret totally. I was just going to say, talking about policies, it's become so complicated, as Natasha was also implying, the governments, you know, and I think I was being a bit diplomatic, but she mentioned the DOJ and SEC. When they come in and do an investigation on FCPA in an emerging market like India, they expect all the reports, all the information. Now, there's something called legal privilege, right? Every country has its own legal privilege. So what information can you share? And then there's data localization, right? So can this data just automatically be picked up and transferred to the US or to Europe? And I think that those are questions which I think countries are now creating shields around, I feel. And, you know, like China has had their, I think, shield. We couldn't just walk into China and do an investigation, right? It doesn't work like that. But you could at one point in time walk into India and do an investigation and walk out with a lot of disks. I'm sure Margaret has operations in India. She could just fly in, fly out. I think that may become a bit more difficult in the future. We may keep Margaret and Natasha longer in India because they'll have to do the investigation sitting in India as a jurisdiction. So things are getting a bit more complicated. Another thing is legal privilege. I like to mention, you know, lawyers love legal. That's how they get a lot of business, because they say you have to work under my legal privilege, because that's how it's, you know, confidential and privileged. I think that's also being tested. Because in a country like India, if you say, oh, I'm a US law firm and I'm doing this investigation under legal privilege, auditors in India have been told by the law that they don't believe that. So the question is, either you share the audit report, investigation report in full and entirety, or they won't sign your audit audited accounts. So you have this whole back and forth happening between countries where the old historical rules may not hold today. And that's creating a lot of pull and push. And I see that a lot between auditors and corporates. In signing off financials, and we're seeing a lot more global issues than we used to in the past. Or a simple thing like whistleblowing, you know, I'm sure I don't know how they have it in HEAT or the companies, but generally it's centralized in the head office. That's also not okay. Now companies are saying you need to have whistleblowing where it's just all shared with us transparently. Otherwise, we as auditors can't sign off of that. So that's again a different dimension which has come in with this whole cross-border issue. So a lot of challenges, but I think exciting times for us as lawyers to grapple and help companies solve.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't say that the Sedona Conference Working Group 6 had a policy, a paper out on the questions of legal privilege and cross-border discovery, because it's a topic near and dear to my heart and many of my fellow Sedonians' heart. So we looked at this quite closely, and how do you approach these, you know, very different questions and very different answers in jurisdictions, you know, where, for instance, discovery doesn't exist. Maybe there isn't the same requirement for privilege as you have in the US, for instance, and, you know, which jurisdictions are most similar to one another? What can you exfiltrate and what can't you? So, again, another resource to look at.
Well, I have tons more questions, which I think is a good thing, because it means we're thinking about all the things we have to worry about in the year ahead, and maybe points to some other episodes we should be doing. But for reasons of time, I'm going to move on to our sort of rapid fire closing questions. So I'd like you to each answer each of these, but, you know, with a quick answer. So the first closing question is, what would be one actionable, monetizable takeaway for our listeners from today?
I'll jump in and say, from a company standpoint, good governance. That's not the same thing as bureaucracy, slow decision-making, and heavy-handedness, but really good governance, so that you understand who the decision-makers are, where the policies come from, and what actions are going to be taken, especially in this rapidly shifting regulatory environment.
I would like to say, don't be penny-wise, pound-foolish on compliance. Don't cut costs you know, this is not the first group you should cut costs with. Invest in compliance and your business will grow.
My answer is a bit similar to Margaret's accountability. You know, it's simple. We developed this accountability wheel, and again, something you can look at, but really where you map your company practice, your organizational practices to having policies in place, making sure there's oversight, making sure there's redress, etc. And so it's a wheel that continues to work, and you can map this for privacy, for your AI oversight, for you know, what have you. That would be probably my main takeaway.
Okay, question number two. If a student or someone more junior would like to do what you do or get into your area, what advice would you give them?
Be versatile. Find your topic that interests you. Don't be deterred if your path isn't straight. You know, be curious.
I would say the same thing. Be curious and celebrate the fact that your path is not straight. And that's how you end up to be a lead legal officer, because you're no longer an expert in any one thing anymore. You rely on the expertise of others.
I would say come to India, you learn a lot in the chaos. It's a growing country and you'll have fun. And I'd like to also add, keep learning. You know, no matter what age you are, if you don't keep learning, you're going to really fade away. I mean, whether it's technology, just keep experimenting and don't just read magazines, actually download software and try it yourself. Do it yourself.
I think we're all traveling to India after this.
Question number three. Can you recommend an article, book, blog, website, talk, or other resource you think our listeners should check out?
Well, for me, it's you know, the Sipple website, which has many, 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 many resources on many of the topics, and it continues to grow, and check out our LinkedIn page as well, where you see a lot of you know, what we are doing, what we are thinking about, with whom we interact, you know, what key takeaways might have been from events we've organized. So if these topics interest you, then that's a good place to start. And other than that, there are so many podcasts, etc. I would find it very difficult to name them all. That, you know, and also I'm quite eclectic, and I jump around a lot because I'm very curious. So, you know, check out our website for resources on all of these. That would be my advice.
I would say, you know, the ACFA website is quite a good one. You get a lot of information on it. I would say in EY, we have the Economist survey, which has come out recently, which is quite interesting. We have the Global Integrity Report coming out. So I think these surveys give you a lot of data points. A lot of times in companies, you have to need data points to justify something. You know, most CEOs will say, why do I spend so much money in this area of compliance? You have to tell them what the risk is. But for risk, you have to define it and give them some data points. So I think that's super helpful with some of these surveys, which can quantify it for you. I would also say, look at a lot of the websites where technology and AI and compliance is being discussed. So I would say, go through that. And I love reading books on people who've made mistakes, you know, that recent scandals. So read some of those. Those are great fun. If you read them properly, you'll realize why people have made mistakes or what has gone wrong.
And I'll maybe completely pivot, because I think those are both great answers. I don't normally read leadership books, but I did recently read the book written by Ginni Rometty called Good Power. She was the CEO of IBM. She'd worked at IBM for many, many years. And there's a lot about the journey of IBM that really resonated with me at Hyatt, because we're a purpose-driven organization. Purpose is important. And also shifting in how we work and working in more agile ways and different ways. And I thought her story from the personal side to her leadership through pretty tumultuous times at IBM and to the why of what mattered to her, you know, the change that they were making and the impact that IBM had on the communities in which it operated, it really resonated with me. And I thought it was just a great story. So Good Power by Ginni Rometty.
Last question, just how can our listeners learn more about you and what you do?
Send me an email and you know, contact me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to share experience and lend an ear or a shoulder.
I would say similarly, follow Hyatt on Instagram, follow Hyatt, especially on LinkedIn, and look us up under www.hyatt.com investor relations site and click through to our World of Care pages. And we do an annual report every year. It's coming out this summer. And if you want to understand what we're about, then understand what World of Care is about.
I would say it's easy to locate us, you know, look up LinkedIn, look up the EY website, and I would love to speak to anybody who's interested. I'm quite passionate about forensic, been doing it for 25 years, so I love it. And if anybody wants to chat, do a research paper, always open.
Well, this was a great discussion, and I really appreciate each of our speakers for taking the time to give us their thoughts today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So I think we have to leave it there. That's going to be it for this episode of Compliance and Legal Risk. I want to thank our guest speakers, the Georgetown Law and EY teams, and of course, all of you for tuning in. If you like what you heard, please check out the resources on our website, subscribe or tell a friend, and leave us a review wherever you're listening. Please keep in mind that the opinions of speakers are their own and do not represent the views of Georgetown University or EY. Nothing presented in Compliance and Legal Risk or on its website should be construed as legal advice or as creating an attorney-client relationship. Until next time, stay compliant and control your legal risks.